From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mush, the Iditarod sled dog race across the Alaskan wilderness is now well underway. Dog teams and their mushers have left the big city of Anchorage on the 1,000-mile journey through southwest Alaska to the town of Nome on the coast of the Bering Sea. The race's history is as deep as the snow, the competition as fierce, the challenges mighty. This hour on Point on the trail of the Iditarod. You can join the conversation beyond the word mush. What do you know about the Iditarod? Can you imagine yourself driving a team of Formula One Huskies across the wilderness? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from along the Iditarod route in Anvik, Alaska, is Susanna Caldwell. She's a reporter for the Alaska Dispatch. Susanna Caldwell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So give us a sense of what's happening on the front lines of the Iditarod Trail. Where are you, first of all, right now?
Right now, I'm in Anvik, Alaska. This is the first checkpoint on the Yukon River. It's quiet right now, actually, after a little bit of excitement earlier this morning. Martin Boozer pulled in at about 2 in the morning to be the first musher to make it to the Yukon, which is a pretty big deal here. He was treated to a 5-course meal, and he's looking good. He's confident about winning the race, actually. So,
Tell me how Alaskans view this race with pride, I assume.
Oh, it's with great pride. It's pretty incredible, especially when you're down in, like, Anchorage in the big city. I mean, thousands of people come out for the ceremonial start. There's only 300,000 people in Anchorage, but it seems like all of them are down there. And you kind of see the same thing as you move along the trail. These villages that a lot of the checkpoints are in, they're very small. Anvik, there's only 80 people. But last night, there was probably 40 people down at the checkpoint when Martin came in at 2 in the morning. Mm. So, lots of support.
So you saw one musher come in at 2 in the morning. How often do you see a musher pass along the trail, Susanna?
Coming through checkpoints?
Yeah.
Pretty frequently. Right now the leaders are they're coming through, so they're a little spread out, but When the sort of middle of the pack start coming through, it's pretty busy. You might see one every hour. I mean, it just kind of depends on how the race is going. But I believe there are 64 mushers still in the race right now. So that's a lot. And yeah, and they're all pretty close together.
64 mushers, and that means how many dogs?
Oh goodness. Most of them started with 16. So I think I've heard 1,000 dogs. It's a lot of dogs.
So what are the conditions, the weather conditions right now? How cold is it, Susanna?
Well, you know that it's warm, which you wouldn't think dog mushing warm.
Well, for Alaska standards, so set the standard for us. What's the temperature?
Well, in Anvik right now, it's 30 degrees. Which, you know, it's below freezing, so that's good. But temperatures in this region generally are closer to zero, or they can get down to 20 below. That's not anything surprising for these people. So everyone's kind of like shaking their heads like, gosh, how is it so warm? It's really kind of crazy.
And does that affect the race?
It does affect the race. Yeah, it seriously affects the race. These dogs need cooler temperatures to run. That's where they're going to thrive. So mushers have to be very keenly aware to how fast the dogs are moving. They have to slow them down a lot because they can risk getting dehydrated. Also, these warm temperatures seriously affect the trail. They need a hard packed trail ideally to get going, and to get that hard packed trail, you need cooler temperatures. With this warm weather, the front mushers might do okay because they're going to come through and they're still going to have that hard trail. But mm-hmm. as more of these guys come through, they're going to break it up and it's going to turn kind of into sand in some places. And so if you've ever run through sand, you can imagine how slow and how tiring that could be. And so that's not what anybody wants.
You mentioned the cooler temperatures and how that affects the animals. As you know, there is concern among some animal rights activists about the treatment of these dogs and their health. We will talk with a veterinarian about that later in the program. Is there concern generally at the race for the health of the dogs, not just this year, but every year?
Oh, of course. I understand that there are 52 veterinarians, 42 of which are on the trail. They swarm these dogs at every checkpoint with their stethoscopes. They're checking their heart rate. They're feeling the dogs for you know, any sort of muscle aches or any sort of you know, internal problems, and they're checking them to make sure that they're hydrated and eating well. And there is so much concern for these dogs. I think you could argue that all of these mushers are sort of crazy dog lovers first and racers second. You know, they stop at a checkpoint, they bed down their dogs, they feed their dogs, they water them, and then they go down the line and they massage their dogs, and they apply foot ointment, and you know, they really take care of these animals. It's their top priority.
Well, you know, you talk about the treatment of the dogs, and seems like you've been there, and I know you have, because you're not only a newspaper reporter, but you grew up in a racing family. Your dad ran the Iditarod 8 times, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us what makes this race so exciting, so unique from a kid's perspective. You've seen it for many years.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it is wild. You know, these people, some of these mushers, for example, Martin Boozer, you know, these are celebrities in Alaska. I don't know if they're celebrities anywhere else, but it's amazing to see them in action, and so serious and so focused. And, you know, you see children in all these little checkpoints. They run around with their notebooks, and they're collecting the autographs, you know. So it's just... It's sort of surreal for me as the daughter of a musher to actually be out on the trail. Because getting to these places, getting to Anvik and Takotna and going down the trail, they're very remote. These are not places that you drive to.
Right.
So for me, that's super exciting to kind of live my own personal history and get to cover this exciting race.
Well, good luck to you there, Susanna Caldwell from the Alaska Dispatch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
She spoke with us along the Iditarod route in Anvik, Alaska. Joining me now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Aaron McLarnon, Communications Director for the Iditarod Trail Committee, the group that organizes the Iditarod Sled Dog Race. Aaron is also co-owner of Broken Runner Kennel in Willow, Alaska, where she's been training sled dogs and mushing for about 15 years. Aaron McLarnon, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. Fill us in on the history of the Iditarod. How'd this all begin?
Well, you know, it's an amazing history that Joe Reddington Sr., the father of the Iditarod, and Dorothy Page, they were seeing how sled dogs were basically disappearing across the Alaska state. They were being replaced by snow machines. And so they both devised this way of this race to go across Alaska to help preserve the sled dog. A lot of people think it's tied to the 1925 Serum Run, which that has a lot of effect on it. I mean, they had a great respect for all those mushers. But it was really just to keep sled dogs in the forefront in Alaska.
We'll talk about that 1925 Serum Run. It's so interesting. We'll talk about that later. But tell us how long the Iditarod Trail is and what is the terrain. I mean, we heard a little bit from Susanna. It's rough out there, isn't it?
It's absolutely rough, and weather can change within any given moment. The trail is approximately 1,000 miles long. There is 2 different routes depending on the year. The odd year, which is this year, they're taking the southern route, which travels through Iditarod, Shagaluk, and Vic. And then in the even years, there's a northern route that at Ophir heads north and goes through Ruby, Galena, Mulatto Cowtag, more down the Yukon River instead of up the Yukon River. You can see lots of variance along this trail. You see everything from flat rivers to big mountains to, you know, huge lake areas, the tundras, just about everything you can imagine Alaska to be, you experience on this trail.
And so who races in the Iditarod? Is it mostly Alaskans?
It's mainly Alaskans, but we definitely have this year, I think we have 5 countries represented that left the start line. We had folks from Jamaica, Brazil, Norway, Canada, of course the USA, but the majority of them, I would say probably about 80% of them are Alaskans or have some ties to Alaska.
And what type of dogs run in the Iditarod?
The most common breed that you see in the Iditarod is called an Alaskan Husky. An Alaskan Husky is basically a northern breed dog that its lineage would have come from the Siberian Husky. But as the temperatures have warmed and dog mushing has become more of kind of a sport of speed, they started breeding in hounds and other types of dogs to get a thinner coat and more of a what I would call a Michael Jordan looking type of dog, a marathon runner type of dog. So, you know, they're basically like your mutt. If you have a mutt at home that loves the pull and is a voracious eater, you can tell people you have an Alaskan Husky because that's what they are.
And so how long does it take? Obviously, there's a big variance here. How long does it take to race the Iditarod? What are your fastest times?
Our fastest time right now, our record holder is John Baker, our 2011 winner, and I think his record was just right around 9 days. So it can take teams anywhere from 9 days to around 15 days. However, you know, the first Iditarod was well over 20 days. So with technology and dog breeding and feeding, those times have come down quite a bit.
Do they stop along the way and rest, or is this full force ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's three mandatory rests. There's one 24-hour mandatory rest and 2 8-hour mandatory rests. But dogs need more than that. A lot of the mushers are what you would call an equal run-rest schedule, whereas if you've just ran your dogs for 6 hours, you're going to rest those dogs for 6 hours or more. And there's strategy in that. Like right now, Jake Berkowitz, even though he might be back a little bit in the team, he actually has more rest on his dog, which could play to his advantage toward the end of the race by having just a little bit of that extra rest.
Behind me is the sound of a team of excited Alaskan Huskies as they move to the starting line of the 2013 Iditarod ceremonial start in Anchorage, Alaska. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We are talking about the Iditarod sled dog race going on right now, and you can join the conversation. Can you imagine cruising across Alaska with a sled and a team of dogs? Is this a dog's dream life? Or do you worry it's too much for them? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me this hour is Aaron McLarnon, Communications Director for the Iditarod Trail Committee, the group that organizes the Iditarod Sled Dog Race. And joining me now from Fairbanks, Alaska, is Dermot Cole, longtime columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and author of North to the Future, The Alaska Story, 1959 to 2009. Dermot Cole, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So give us the historical significance of this race in Alaska and beyond.
Well, the race really dates back in one sense to the 1925 epidemic of diphtheria in Nome. At least it traces its roots to that event. Nome was a very isolated community, and in the middle of winter, children were getting sick with diphtheria, and there was no vaccine. And the only way to get there was by dog team. And there was an epic journey, dog team relay, that basically went from the interior of Alaska to Nome that helped save the lives of children. And sort of that whole episode looms large in Alaska today, and the Iditarod, in a sense, you know, is modeled on that event. It was a sort of the height of glory of the sled dog in Alaska.
The Great Mercy Race, the Great Race of Mercy, as it was known, right? And there's a statue, right, of one of the dogs from that race, Balto, in New York Central Park. I've walked past that thing so many times. That Siberian Husky. Quite a symbol for many in Alaska.
Well, that's definitely true. In fact, two of the most famous dogs in Alaska history are memorialized in a sense. Balto, the statue of Balto in Central Park, was placed there shortly after Balto led a dog team was at the front of the first dog team to reach Nome to help end that diphtheria epidemic. And, you know, millions of children from all over the world have seen that statue and played on it in Central Park. The Togo is another one of the famous dogs that was highlighted after the diphtheria run. Of course, there are actually hundreds of dogs that were involved. It's just that the press singled these animals out, and they became, personalities in their own right.
Has the trail changed? Has the Iditarod Trail itself changed or evolved over the years?
Well, yes, it has. Now, the Iditarod race goes from Anchorage, which is on the southern south-central coast of Alaska, to Nome, which is on the sort of in the northwestern part of the state. Now, just to give an idea of size here, Alaska is twice the size of Texas, and where I am is in Fairbanks, and I am about 400 miles from where the leaders of this race are now. So it's like the difference between New York and Cleveland from Fairbanks to Anvik, where the leader of the race is right now. So, you know, things are pretty spread out here, and while I said Alaska is twice the size of Texas, we have as many road miles as Rhode Island about. So everything travels by airplane here today, generally. And the dog team is sort of the what occurred before there was an airplane here. And so the Iditarod helps commemorate that history and that legacy. The trail, I said it changed. It does change to some degree, but the real changes are in the dogs who participate in it, the mushers who participate in it. And it began as a long camping trip that took a few weeks. But today it's not a camping trip at all.
Right. It's quite serious.
An endurance test.
Let me take a call here from Solya. She's in Wisconsin. Hi, Solya. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
I have a sort of two-part question. I would like to know if there are traditional peoples, native peoples, who participate or did participate in the race. And also, how much does it cost? Is it an expensive venture to be part of it?
Thank you, Solya. Let's turn to Dermot first. What about that? Are there native Alaskans participating in the Iditarod?
Yes, there are. And many native Alaskans take great pride in this event now. And it has been, there's growing interest, really, among native Alaskans in the sport. And as it has become more sophisticated, the mushers have developed the tools they need to make this kind of a year-round occupation. And for the top mushers, this is a year-round enterprise. They take care of the dogs all the time, and there's a lot of work through the summer, and they really love these animals.
Training themselves and training the dogs well.
That's true. They do it. And one thing in that regard, at one time, the mushers, there were a lot of the guys who weren't particularly in great shape. But that has changed over the years, and the physical conditioning, the aerobic condition of the mushers has become more important over the years.
Aaron McLaurin, what about the cost? Solya, the caller, asked about the cost of participating in this race. Aaron, are you there? I think we've lost Aaron. Dermot, do you know?
Well, no, I guess I don't know a figure off the top of my head, but it's tens of thousands of dollars because dog food is expensive, and you need it, 365 days a year. So the real successful mushers do this all the time. It's not a weekend hobby.
Right.
That they devote their lives to.
They're professionals.
And it's very difficult actually to have a life outside of dog mushing when you're a professional musher.
Let me take another call here from Norfolk, Virginia. Lauren, are you there? Welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I am just a dog lover, and I was just wondering how do you explain that at least 20 dogs have died during the race since 2005? This is really concerning to me.
It is concerning to a lot of people, Lauren. Would you speak to that, Dermot? Historically, what has been the treatment of the animals on the Iditarod Trail?
Well, the dog care today is vastly superior to what it was when this started, and I think in part because people were raised concerns continually about that very issue, the number of dog deaths in these races. It's now at a point where there's a few per year, generally, really the people most upset about this are these mushers. They it's hard for me to describe just how attached they become to the animals. They're not quite pets, but it's a very it's like a family relationship almost. The care is improved. The animals are not being mistreated. Lisa, that's my sort of unprofessional opinion of this, having watched this for many years.
Well, let me bring another voice into
Let me just add one more thing about the deaths. And I've written about this before. If you consider how many unwanted animals are killed in shelters or die from neglect during that same period, even in Alaska, in the animal shelters in Anchorage and Fairbanks and other major cities, it far exceeds the number of animals that die in these distance races. And so that's just
let me bring in from North Grafton, Massachusetts now, Dr. Claire Sharp. She is assistant professor at Tufts University's Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine, specializing in emergency medicine and critical care. Dr. Sharp, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me about the care and keeping of these dogs. I know we've received a lot of comments about this, and I'm curious how you see it.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember, too, that care has evolved over time. I can speak from my knowledge of the literature and also my role in the veterinary profession. As a member of the veterinary profession and the American Veterinary Medical Association, our organization of veterinary professionals supports the humane and ethical use of animals in sports such as sled dog racing. And while we understand that Alaskan sled dogs are a genetically distinct population of dogs that have been shaped by selective inbreeding to create these high-performance athletes, certainly they can have health problems. And so veterinarians are very integrally involved in research to help minimize illness and death in these dogs, and also actually during the race to make sure that dogs are evaluated, and if they need to be retired from the race, they can be retired.
I'm reading here some research in front of me from Oklahoma State College of Veterinary Medicine. Racing Alaskan sled dogs, they say, develop exercise-induced airway inflammation, that sled dogs have airway dysfunction similar to ski asthma, that these findings suggest that repeated exercise in cold conditions can lead to airway disease, among other things, intestinal permeability, other such issues. Are there potentially high risks for these dogs, or are they bred for this kind of run?
Yeah, these dogs are absolutely bred for this, and there's been some very interesting work done through the National Institutes of Health Genome Research Institute that shows that they are very different dogs to our average pet dogs, and those genetic changes that have been created by breeding of these dogs really does allow them to perform in these conditions where other dogs would not be able to perform. But that being said, we do know that these dogs have changes in their stomach and intestines, in their lungs and their respiratory tract, in their muscles, and in their ability to tolerate heat and cold. And some of these changes are somewhat academic in that when researchers like those at Oklahoma State University study these dogs, we can identify differences not only between these dogs and healthy dogs, but also between these dogs before and after they race. And many of these changes are of academic interest because they give us an idea about what happens in the bodies of athletes, and that information can translate to human athletes as well. But few of the changes that we find in these dogs in the research studies that have been done are actually associated with clinically significant changes in the dogs. So, for example, the changes in the lungs of the dogs very rarely compromises their respiratory capacity. In fact, these dogs have a much greater respiratory capacity than the average dog that you would have at home, or even a dog that's well exercised. Some of the changes in the stomach and intestines in these dogs and their increased risk of inflammation in their stomach and of gastric ulceration can predispose them to problems, and that's something that researchers have been very actively looking at.
Yeah. Let me bring in Erin McLernan for a minute and ask her about what's your official response, Erin, to so many people who do have some concerns about the dogs and how they deal in these races?
Yeah, you know, and that's always been a concern, and we take the utmost care of these dogs. We haven't had a dog death on the trail in over 3 years. Before this race even starts, these dogs go through extensive medical workups. Each musher can have 24 dogs that have ECGs, blood work, and microchipping done. So each dog, I mean, I've never even had an, for humans, it's EKGs. I've never even had an EKG. That they monitor all of these. These are then sent to specialists in those areas to study all of this. And then the veterinarians get back in touch with these mushers if they see any abnormalities. And then just within a few days of the race, all of those dogs go through another extensive hands-on physical examination where, you know, veterinarians are listening to hearts and listening to the lungs and checking all the muscles and all the bone structure to make sure they are ready to hit the trail.
And so, Erin, what are some of the challenges this year with the weather as temperate as it is? What is the challenge for these dogs?
The challenge this year is just the temperatures. We've been seeing temperatures in the 20s, 30s, and I've even seen some GPS trackers picking up in the 40s. And that makes these dogs travel a little bit slower, and you have to make sure you keep these dogs well hydrated. And so, you know, mushers are having to, you know, snack these dogs more with, you know, we use a lot of fish because they're high in water content, or you have to stop along the trail and melt snow to hydrate these dogs. So that's, you know, that's the main concern, but it, you know, it's absolutely, you know, it can be taken care of. You've just got to do more running at night and resting during the day when the, you know, and run at night when it's cooler.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Claire Sharp, why are certain breeds, specifically the Alaskan and Siberian Huskies, better suited for sled racing?
One of the things that we've found from the genetic studies that have been done is that they're more tolerant of heat than other dogs, which sounds sort of contraindicated because they're racing in very cold conditions. But when they race for hours and hours and hours and days and days and days, they develop a lot of heat in their muscles. And that, in other dogs, can cause a lot of muscle damage. And so we know that these dogs have genetic changes in their muscles that allow their muscles to continue to work as they produce heat. And so these dogs can exercise a lot longer and a lot harder than your average dog can. So that's one of the main differences that we've found in Alaskan sled dogs that allows them to be such high-performance athletes.
Here's a comment from one of our listeners. I think animal abuse is when people get huskies and don't run them like they need to be. They are in a pack and doing what they love. Have you ever seen a pent-up husky? They act like crazy wild animals because they love to run. Dr. Claire Shipp, respond, please.
Yeah, so I think that certain dogs that are bred for certain purposes definitely are most contented when they're doing what they should do. And for people that own huskies as pets that are not conditioned to exercise, they wouldn't be able to run like a husky runs in the Iditarod. But those dogs definitely operate a different way to perhaps a small breed dog that's quite happy to sit on the couch and watch TV. So those dogs really need a very active owner who can make plans and train them and things like that so that they can get the exercise and mental stimulation that they need. So I'm not sure I would say that it's cruel. I know a lot of people that own working dogs as pets, but it's just really important to make sure that those dogs are exercised and mentally stimulated the way they need to be. But undoubtedly, when sled dogs are racing, they're just in heaven. That's all they want to do. And, you know, you'll see these dogs continue to run after their owner's off the back, after their musher's off the back. They just want to keep running. They love to run, and they were bred to run.
Erin McLarnon, how many dogs this year in the race?
This year in the race, we have over 1,000 dogs because we had 66 teams leave the start line. And each team is probably about an average of 15 dogs. So and right now, we have still 62 teams on the trail, and they've still got some big teams out there. You know, Martin Boozer still has 14 in his team. I know Luan Marquis from Brazil still has his full 16-dog team. So there's still a lot of dogs moving along that trail out
so
there.
So you start with 15 dogs. Does the musher end up with 15 dogs at the end of the race?
No, you start with a maximum of 16 or a minimum of 12. And as you go along the race, you do what we call drop dogs. And each of these checkpoints along the way, there's veterinarians that help you monitor your team. So if you have a dog that's not eating well or drinking well or functioning properly, you know, is sore, mm-hmm, or there's even mm-hmm. strategy to dropping dogs because you can only travel as fast as your slowest dog. Mm. And so they have to cross the finish line with at least 6 on the tow line.
Well, thank you very much, Erin McLarnon. Stick with us. Dr. Claire Sharp, assistant professor at Tufts Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine. I appreciate your expertise today, Dr. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at the Iditarod sled dog race now underway in Alaska. And behind me is the sound of musher Luan Marquez and his team of Alaskan Huskies back in February as they trained for this year's Iditarod. With me this hour is Aaron McLarnon, Communications Director for the Iditarod Trail Committee, organizers of the Iditarod sled dog race, and Dermot Cole, columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and author of North to the Future, The Alaska Story, 1959 to 2009. Here's the Iditarod. It has two starts, a ceremonial start in the city of Anchorage, Alaska, and a start of the race in neighboring Willow, Alaska. Here's sound from the ceremonial start this year in Anchorage.
3, 2, 1. Go! Honorary musher position number one in honor of Jan Newton, the sled being driven by Noah Pereira, winner of the 2013 Junior Iditarod.
Let's go right to the phones. Burlington, Vermont. Jeannie is on the line. Hi, Jeannie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a comment, I guess, more than anything else,
okay.
And that is that Seward, Alaska was historically the most northern ice-free port in Alaska, and I know this because I was born and raised there. I actually worked for part of a summer on opening up the original Iditarod Trail a little bit to hikers. Mm. And I wanted to point out as well that Anchorage, in fact, was not even a city when the original Iditarod was run.
Mm. Mm. Have you seen an Iditarod? Have you watched it?
I have, yes.
And what's it like?
It's exciting. It's hard not to pick up the excitement when the dogs are, you know, pulling and antsy and ready to go.
Are they passing? Are the mushers and their dogs passing each other? Are they just forging straight ahead? What is it like, sort of, what's the choreography of this?
For the ceremonial start, it's usually, I believe, a little more kind of in line. People kind of take their turns. I know that on the trail, though, a lot of times, a lot of mushers will travel together, partly for safety and partly just to kind of help keep an eye out on each other.
This year, it's really, really warm for Alaska. But, I mean,
yeah.
In years past, it gets terribly cold. I remember being there years ago as a young network correspondent doing a story on the Iditarod, and it was, I mean, 20 below. Do you remember that?
I know what that's like.
Yes. All right. Let's go to another call. Ashish is from Watertown. You're welcome. Thank you for calling. Ashish is calling from Watertown, New York. Welcome to the program. Ashish, hello.
Hi, Jay, and thank you for having me.
Yes.
I just had a comment, actually. I was born and raised in Kathmandu, Nepal, and the relation that I was trying to make was with the sled dogs and the Tibetan Mastiffs that we have up in the mountains, up in the Himalayas, where they are trained, they are bred to be those dogs. They roughly weigh between 125 and 175 pounds, and, you know, for generations, they have been bred to do that task. So, I mean, rightfully so, I understand that people are concerned about this race and, like, the well-being of the dogs, but I don't think the problem is with the race itself or the dogs themselves. I think the problem is with the handlers. For instance, my parents were Tibetan Mastiff breeders.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, they only did this for a few years, we bred beautiful dogs, and they were well-trained, they were certified. But the problem that we saw later down the road, and this is one of the reasons why my parents stopped breeding Tibetan Mastiffs, is because we saw a lot of underground breeding and, dogs that weren't really capable of doing such tasks being sold to these people to, do their job in the mountains. And
mm-hmm.
when they couldn't perform the task, rightfully so, activists and stuff, they hopped in and, shut the entire program down.
So what you're saying, it's well monitored, is what you're saying, Ashish. I thank you for your call. Let's get another listener here, Peter from New York. Peter, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I can speak directly to the care of these dogs.
Okay, good.
The care that they receive. I actually am back in Saranac Lake, New York, after about a year of working specifically with Iditarod dogs, long-distance racing dogs, and I worked as a... I guess you could call it a dog handler, an assistant in these kennels. I put a lot of training miles on the dogs. I've been a pet owner my whole life, and the care that these dogs receive not only during races, but their home care at the kennels, their diets are just phenomenally monitored. They are massaged. Dogs that are in successful racing kennels, they're treated like world-class athletes.
Are there examples where it goes the other way, though, Peter?
you know, there's examples of that sort of thing in every walk of life. So I'm sure that there are. I can only speak from my firsthand experience, and I've worked with 5 or 6 different long-distance racers' dogs, and those dogs have just, they've been phenomenally taken care of. And I'm actually, you know, really pleased and proud to say that I've had a hand in working with some of these dogs.
Well, I'm glad you called to tell us about it, Peter. Thank you very much. Aaron McLarnon, is it true that the dogs are not driven by reins, but by spoken commands? I read that last night. I wonder if that's true.
That's absolutely true. We all use the commands G, which is right, haw is left, whoa is supposed to mean stop, but a lot of times that doesn't mean a whole lot. It takes a lot of pressure on a brake sometimes to get these dogs to stop. And some of us have our own little commands to talk to these dogs. And it's amazing how they respond to even the, you know, just the tone of your voice. I mean, they can tell when you're nervous, excited, happy. So you've got to learn to be actually very monotone so those dogs can't read you all that well, because it's amazing what they can pick up on.
I guess they're trained to do that since they were puppies, huh?
That's exactly right.
Give us some more mushing, some more Iditarod terminology. We know what mushing is. Double, you heard it, you gave us G and ha. What's a double lead? Give us some other things.
Well, a double lead is where you have 2 lead dogs up front. Most people run 2 lead dogs. I know I have a tendency when I'm out on the trail, I've been to Nome 7 times. A lot of times I'll run an odd number of dogs, so I have an opportunity if I need to run a single leader, because you have different leaders for different conditions. It's rare to have that one leader that's absolutely awesome in everything. I mean, once in a blue moon we are blessed with an animal, you know, like that. But double lead, single lead, we have wheel dogs. Those are the dogs right in the front of your sled. You have the team dogs, which are the dogs in the middle of the team, kind of what I call the horsepower. You have swing dogs, which are the dogs directly behind the leaders. You have, of course, the dog sled, and you have the brush bow. That's the piece of plastic that comes off the front of the sled.
Mm-hmm.
You have the driving bow, which is what you hold on to steer the sled. It's amazing the terminology and the technology and the things that go into getting these dogs along the trail.
Complicated operation. Virginia, you're on the line. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've been living in Alaska for the past 35 years, and I'm sort of an Iditarod nut, you would call it. I love the Iditarod. And one thing I just wanted to mention is, not only are the dogs so incredible, I go up on the Deshka River and watch, you know, the teams go by. These dogs would gladly, literally perish for what they're doing. They just absolutely love every minute of what they're doing. But the mushers are so inspiring, and for us Alaskans to have people like Susan Butcher, Lance Mackey, who has battled throat cancer and won several years consecutively, as well as the Yukon Quest. Dee Dee John Rowe, who has fought breast cancer, continues to run to this day. These people are so inspiring, and all of us from Alaska are so incredibly proud to have them, you know, representing us. And there is no abuse of any animals on this race. It is a race of people that love what they're doing, and they live it 365. They, you know, there's no just a season of the Iditarod. This is these people's lives. Mm. And we in Alaska are just incredibly proud to have them in our midst, and it's a great sense of pride for us. I just wanted to mention that the mushers themselves are really remarkable people.
Well, let's hear from one of them. Virginia, I appreciate your call. You mentioned Lance Mackey. I actually have a piece of sound from him here. He's a longtime participant, 4-time winner of the Iditarod. He's competing in this year's race. He says taking proper care of the dogs is very important to him.
It's my job to figure out how to get them to go 1,000 miles, happy, healthy, you know. Unfortunately, they're animals and things happen, right? Accidents happen every day to humans. Dogs have gastric ulcers and myopathy. These are 2 things that aren't detected in all the tests that we do, EKGs, blood work, drug testing, you know. We're doing everything in our power to prevent a dog death.
Aaron McLarnon, would you respond to that?
And that's absolutely key. And, you know, like a lot of times when I tell people, I mean, look at the population of dogs that we have leaving the starting line. It's over 1,000 dogs over a two-week time period. And like I said, we have been dog death-free for over 3 years. Take that same amount of populations of dogs, and let's say in New York City, I don't think 1,000 dogs in New York City are going to be death-free over a two-week time period, because these dogs are monitored so closely, not only by the veterinarians, but the mushers themselves. Like I said, I'm a musher. I've been across Alaska on dogs. And, you know, every moment you stop, you evaluate, you've stood behind these dogs, you know how these dogs run. And if you see a flick of the ear or a slight little stumble, you pick that up, you know, instantaneously, because you know exactly how these dogs should be performing. And when you see that, you think something's wrong. So you stop immediately and you start evaluating to see what the issue could be. And then if there is an issue, you put the dog in the sled and you haul him to the next checkpoint.
Let's bring in Dave from Bloomingdale, New York. Hi, Dave. Thanks for waiting and welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I had a really good friend of mine in Lake Placid, New York, who had about a 20-dog team that he would take tourists out on Lake Placid and Mira Lake there. And he gave me one of his Siberian Huskies when she got a little bit old. And by the way, all these dogs had their own dog houses, and they lived a really nice life. But anyway, he gave me that Tasha, the Siberian Husky, and a small racing sled. Mm. And Tasha and I would go out to all the lakes here in the Adirondack. Mm-hmm. In January, February, and March, if it was allowable. And we just had a great time. But every single time I got that harness out to put her, you know, to go somewhere, she was just so ecstatic and excited. And the other funny thing, too, is I live in a log cabin way back in the woods here. She never really slept inside at night all winter long. She always liked to be outside.
Mm. That's the life. The life of a dog. Sounds like you had a pretty good life, too, growing up, Dave. Thank you very much for the call. Great memories. Thanks. Here's Alex in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. How old are you?
I'm 9.
You're 9. Do you have a question about the Iditarod?
Yeah. We're, my class is following the Iditarod, and I just wanted to see how Lance Mackey was doing.
Okay. A play-by-play. We've got it for you, Alex. Thank you very much. A good thing to be following there in school. Aaron McLarnon, any thoughts? Do you know?
Well, that's what I was just going to check up for him and see where Lance is sitting right now.
He's a favorite. He has been in years past, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you go to Iditarod.com and you can go and check the current standings all day, all night long. And I'm checking my list here, and it looks like, goodness gracious, let's see here. Lance Mackey is sitting in sixth place. He's been out of Shagaluk. He left Shagaluk, it looks like, at 6:42 this morning. So he's back on the trail, making his way toward Anvik.
All right, Alex, there you go. You heard it here. You can go tell your class. Happy studying, Alex. Thanks for the call. Hey, Aaron, in keeping with tradition, tell me about the widow's lamp at the Iditarod that lights up at 10 a.m. the first Sunday in March in Nome at the trail's end.
That's right. The widow's lamp, also known as the red lantern, that's up in Nome. They light that that lantern when the first musher leaves the start line in Willow, and that light is lit until the last musher crosses that finish line when it's extinguished. Mm. And it's just to let all those mushers know that we're thinking about them, and we're praying for all of them, the safe travels across Alaska, and that we have, you know, our thoughts on them until that last person
until the light stays on. Right. So Dermot Cole, the widow's lamp is not to be confused with the tradition of the red lantern. What's that?
Well, the red lantern is the sort of award, if you might say, for the last musher across the finish line. And for many people, they don't mind finishing last. What they do love is participation in this in the race. One of the biggest changes in recent years, hearing that student ask about Lance Mackey reminded me of this, is that the ability to track the mushers by GPS, that's changed dramatically. There was a time when the GPS, carrying a GPS, was prohibited. But the Iditarod has changed with the change in media so that people around the world can track the mushers.
And I might
throw in one more thing here.
Okay.
Many of these top mushers are known by their first names in Alaska. That's how well regarded and recognized they are.
Somewhat superstars. Yeah. I hear it. Lance and the others, that sounds like they're very popular. Erin McLaren, how has technology changed the race?
You know, I'll admit, mushing is an awful spectator sport. Once those teams leave the line, it's really hard for the fan to grasp what's going on. And these introduction of the GPS trackers, our insider video crew that's uploading video from all along the trail, has been able to bring these armchair mushers from around the world to be a part of this last great race on Earth. So it's just been able to increase the fan base and keep people in touch of what's really going on out there.
Erin, you've been doing this a long time. I hear the excitement in your voice. We talked about a lot of issues this hour related to the Iditarod. What's in it for you? Why is it such a personal passion of yours?
You know, I've always loved animals my entire life, and these dogs are just simply amazing. Like I said, I've had the great opportunity to go to Nome on the 800-mile serum run 7 times, and it's incredible what these dogs can do. I have been in weather 50 below and better. I've been in awful windstorms, and how these dogs persevere. They're the ones who get me to Nome. There have been so many times that I've just wanted to give up because I'm cold. You're kind of at your wit's end, but then you look at these dogs and how happy they are, and they're yelling and screaming at 50 below, and the wind is blowing furiously, and it's like, I can't quit, because these dogs don't want to quit, and
well,
so it's that mystique.
We've lived it. We hear it in you and the others this hour. Thank you very much for your time. Erin McLaren, Communications Director for the Iditarod Trail. Good luck to you up there, Erin. Thanks.
Yep, thank you.
Dermot Cole, longtime columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Dermot, thanks for your perspectives.
Right, thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Good to be with you this week. I'm Jane Clayson. Tom's back on Monday. Thanks, listeners. This is On Point.